Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the whole crew today, Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer, Abigail Walls, the boss John Rurink, and Simon Schuster. A little later, we're going to listen to Simon's interview with the new gubernatorial candidate, Abdul El-Sed. He was able to speak with Mr. El-Sed after his announcement on Saturday at Eastern Market. But first, guys, we're still trying to make sense out of what we saw on Thursday morning, Wednesday night, with the House deciding to take a vote on the income tax. I guess it was a scale back. It was not a full-fledged elimination. Jack, I want to start with you, having covered the House for several years prior. Get your impressions on what you saw and what you think the impact could be going forward.
Well, I think that it kind of violated what had been the traditional way you do things. You know, number one, you know, if you have the votes, you put them up and vote. If you don't have the votes, you don't vote. You work out other things, or you try to take a little bit of time to get the votes. And instead, they just went right ahead, threw the vote up after considerable hours of talking about it and so on. You end up with 12 Republicans voting no. Why that had to take place when it did is the question I think everybody's asking. Are those going to be bad votes a year and a half from now as they face primaries? How's it all going to work out? I think it's just a major question marks across the board on why you go ahead and do that and why you do it. What was the hurry and what was the need to do that immediately?
Well, and I think we're going to find out. And I think this is an answer that we're not going to find out for some time, because as you said, Jack, we've kind of broken the mold here. I mean, Speaker Leonard wanted to have a vote on the income tax. He wanted it memorialized on the board. Maybe he didn't feel like talking about it more would get you more votes. Or maybe he just wanted some kind of philosophical gut check, or members of his caucus wanted a philosophical gut check. Put it up and see where everybody is. Roll the dice, and this is what happened. And you get the philosophy and you get the vote, and maybe that's a win in a sense, which kind of seems like a mentality of a minority caucus. But it just didn't seem like, Abigail, like there's been a lot of fire behind an income tax reduction. There is in the state house, but in the general public, when you were covering campaigns for the state house this year, that didn't seem to be a topic that was brought up a heck of a lot.
No, not really. I mean, when you talk to even new candidates, folks running for re-election, I mean, the auto insurance rates was the top thing people mentioned, followed by roads, followed by
Obamacare.
Affordable Care Act. That was the thing that they ran on. I mean, I really cannot recall tax rollback of any kind. I mean, people always like to see money saved, and I think maybe you could wrap that philosophically up with the insurance rate reduction, but I don't remember it at all.
It makes you wonder, John, how serious they were about actually getting this through then, because there are a lot of different tactics a speaker can do to get momentum behind a particular issue, and there's a lot of things that he can do to try and get the votes, but there was no buildup on this at all. It was, we're going to vote, where do you stand, and here it goes.
Yeah, I think if the objective were to actually accomplish an income tax cut, that they could have taken more time. They clearly could have worked with Democrats on finding something that Democrats wanted. There was talk of revenue sharing on one point. There was talk of different exemption changes. I'm sure they could have gotten the votes they really wanted to, but it seemed to be more of a ideologically pure attempt at an income tax rollback to accomplish like a party objective more than anything else.
I guess what's most astounding to me about the whole affair is that how private and insular the actual execution of it was. You know, this is something that perhaps for the people that were most loyal to it, the people in the Republican caucus that felt that this was the right thing to do, they could have gone home to the districts, they could have met with people, they could have talked it out with their constituents and made it a political event. But instead it was something that largely happened behind closed doors. And because of that, I think that that might bring some negative effects down the line for the speaker.
And I think that behind closed doors mentality is what makes it so difficult to know how this is going to fall out in the caucus from an outside perspective. I mean, at least from where I stand, it seems like it really is going to matter what Speaker Leonard and his leadership team did over the weekend. That's going to determine how things will fall out on Tuesday.
And if there's something that they want to bring up initially, try and bring everyone together. It seems to me that there's got to be an issue out there that all Republicans can get behind and that they can get a caucus win by putting something on the board they can all support. I don't know if it necessarily needs to have Democrats on it or not, but something that brings them back together, makes them feel good, and gets them on a positive path. Jack, what do you think that they have? What do you think the fallout is going to be going forward?
I think it's very difficult to tell because it's so early. And what is it, what is Leonard going to do, and what are the House Republicans going to do from here on? The only concept I have of this being having any real purpose is if you continue to move ahead over the next year and a half with trying to get other tax cuts, and then you're setting up a situation where, you know, these people can make up for that vote if necessary. Other than that, what the point was in going up and having showing that you did not have the votes for something, I find it extremely difficult to understand what that accomplished.
And I think we'll find out later if this is a coalescing moment for the Republican caucus or if this is a splinter job, because I wonder, my thought here is that what we've seen now is a validation that this is going to be even a more conservative Republican caucus than we have seen even with the Cotter caucus. And if Rick Snyder now with his last 2 years in office is going to find it even more difficult to get through his agenda items. If you take a look at his agenda items now that he's wanted to talk about, he's talked about infrastructure, he's talked about doing something with municipal finance. How much more difficult is it going to be to get through his agenda now when he realizes that this is a caucus that is willing to die on the sword for what it believes in? On the form of, you know, this being an income tax, they're willing to die on the sword for what they believe in. And how more difficult is this going to be for Snyder to get anything done that he wants?
Except the operative word is that they died on their sword. I think it would have been more difficult for them, for him, if they would have actually passed this. And then he had to deal with it in some real substantial way down the line. I think at the end of the day, what it creates is you've got a core group of Republicans. You've got probably a willing Democratic minority. You've got some maneuverability there to play with that a weakened speaker actually enables more.
I do think that the amount of temperance that a leader can exact over a caucus this conservative really matters. I mean, look at the congressional level, the demise of the Freedom Caucus. I mean, if you effectively become a do-nothing party, if you can't in some way enmesh your ideology with the rest of the system, if you can't in some way get something done, it has a tendency to kind of come back to bite.
If you want to concoct some kind of silver lining in this, if you want to try to look at the possible plus from the speaker's standpoint, I think you could say, okay, number one, how many of those 12 are going to want to continue to defy the caucus on other conservative issues? Do you put them in a position where they're more likely to feel they have to go along later with some of the more conservative points on other issues? Again, that's looking for a silver lining. That's trying to find something. The other problem I think you have here is basically if you're Leonard and you're trying to possibly come around and say at some point that, look, in order to do something, we're going to have to coalesce around this or that issue, then maybe it helps the governor. Maybe Leonard then at some point has to pick up on some of the governor's things, sort of prove to his the core of his caucus, you're going to keep getting 51, you're going to keep getting 52, you're going to keep getting 50, and you're not going to get anything done if you don't kind of come over and move a little bit toward the center.
That's possible, but it could also mean that getting something done isn't necessarily what the end objective here. The end objective could be to move Lansing more to the right. And if that means that they don't get 55 votes to eliminate Common Core or to get rid of smart meters or whatever the extreme conservative agenda may be, well, we didn't get it this time, but that just shows that we are committed here. And maybe we don't get it in 18, but maybe we get a more conservative governor who sees our way in 2020 and we get it in 2020.
Again, though, like I said, what I was talking about is if you want to concoct a silver lining,
right,
I think you have to go quite a ways.
All right. Well, we're going to turn the page here a second. Over the weekend, we had some news on the gubernatorial front before we hit on our interview here with Simon. Over in the town of Berkeley, in the nice Oakland County hamlet, in the Democratic Club, where there is usually 15 Democrats who meet on a Sunday to talk about politics, we had over 200 people cram into a restaurant to acknowledge and listen to gubernatorial candidate Gretchen Whitmer. Now, Gretchen Whitmer, it does seem like, being one of the most pronounced and active Democratic gubernatorial candidates, is taking advantage of a public sentiment right now, an anti-Trump sentiment here, in which she is able to maybe not necessarily draw it by herself, but she is filling a void right now of in which people are extremely angry. They want to talk. They want to vent their frustration, and she is giving them an avenue to do it, John. It seems like this idea of hers to come out early, for now, is paying some dividends.
Oh, I think it's paying some great dividends, but it's a great landscape for her right now. Think about the contrast. She can contrast herself with Rick Snyder, who presided over the Flint water disaster. She can contrast herself with Donald Trump, who's tripping over himself almost daily in Washington, D.C., and has endured enormous amount of angst and anger among Democrats. So it's a great time for her. Whether or not that continues is up to her. I think what she really has to do, though, is define a vision that she can explain to the state of Michigan about where she wants to take the state and how she actually pragmatically does it.
Abigail, I want you to address the subject here. One word, L-I-S-T.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we've all been hard on the Democratic Party over this past election cycle, but the effort they put forward to build their texts list at the Democratic Convention, the effort that Gretchen has put forward to build her text list, her email list, I mean, you see other candidates copying this. I mean, that list sharing, that list exchange, that list building has a lot of value, not just for contacting and activating local units of voters, but down the line value in more accurate polling and voter modeling, creating stronger walk lists, and so on and so on.
This couldn't be turning out any better for Gretchen Whitmer than it is right now, I would say.
I'd say to an extent, yes. I mean, a lot of what she's doing right now is consolidating and securing her power among liberal activists so that when it comes to, you know, getting out of ground game and knocking doors, that she will have these people who are already loyal to her message and her vision for the state. But the thing is, when you look at this, similar to like Barack Obama's first term and the 2010 midterms, this this wave of emotion, of outrage, it began this movement, but it was ideological principles that sustained it. And I think that that centrality of vision, of message, is still going to be what's key.
All right, Simon. So let's transition to the other big news from this weekend. We had a new Democratic gubernatorial candidate enter the fray formally, Abdul El Said. Give us your impressions on what you saw at Eastern Market.
Well, he had a remarkably well-produced campaign kickoff. There was about maybe 200 to 300 people in attendance. It was in Eastern Market shed. He stood at a podium with the bustling Eastern Market in the background, with the Detroit skyline in the distance. And he delivered a speech that was touched on many of the progressive liberal talking points that have mobilized a lot of the Democratic base in the beginning days of Donald Trump's presidency.
Why should we take him seriously?
Well, I mean, he's running on his essentially impeccable credentials. He became a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford after getting his bachelor's at the University of Michigan, got a PhD in epidemiology at Columbia, and became a professor there, and then returned to Detroit to become the director of public health. He's going to use that position as director as some of his track record and to perhaps better articulate real-world examples of his vision for the state.
Why shouldn't we take him seriously?
Well, I mean, there are stumbling points that, you know, upstate his background. Mr. El Said is a devout Muslim, and upstate, you know, it's unfortunate to say, but Islamophobia is still something that's, you know, quite widespread throughout most of this country. And so as a result, this is going to be something where he has to articulate his vision that is beyond religion, beyond background. And he did a somewhat successful job of that. At the beginning of his speech, in the kickoff, he had two Christian pastors first deliver them, and then a humanist Jew also deliver an invocation. And he really was trying to bring a message of unity to a fractured country, you might say.
Jack, what's your thoughts here?
I think somebody coming in from the outside with this kind of background would probably have some difficulty connecting with the average blue-collar worker and folks like that. But I also believe that after Donald Trump, we may see more and more people with backgrounds that don't seem to make sense in terms of running for office jumping into these things. Because this was the guy pulling off, the candidate pulling off something no one thought they could, and that's going to make a lot of other people say, hey, why not me? It crosses my mind that someone like this could get in with the thought that he might be a kingmaker. He might ultimately get a certain backing from certain people that he could then use later on in a gubernatorial race to put himself in a good position to make deals. But I wouldn't even, I don't, that may be too soon to even go there. I think right now it's just the idea that, you know, somebody's out there, they've seen other people win that weren't supposed to, and why not get in, especially when you got this much intellectual firepower in terms of your background.
Certainly a young man, 30, right?
Yes, he is in his early 30s.
Yeah, so, I mean, certainly idealistic here and maybe sees an opportunity to, at the very least, soften the hardened attitude that this state does seem to have among Muslim Americans and people of Arab descent who have come to Michigan more so than any other state, maybe outside of California, but in higher concentrations we're seeing them in our area. And I want to get your perception on this, Abby, coming from Dearborn, where obviously there's a lot of Muslim Americans, Arab Americans. Do you think that let me ask you this, how has Dearborn done as far as embracing the culture and how quickly can that spread statewide?
I think that this message really matters. On what level does the message transfer? If he tries to push it across traditional partisan lines, traditional progressive lines, I think he gets railroaded off that pretty quick by the Whitmer campaign. But if he tries to maybe take a more indirect path and allow this to move across young people, move across, as you point out, cultural lines, I think he has a lot more success. Because I think one thing you do see in Dearborn that you're kind of getting at is that a lot of the culture from these Arab or Middle Eastern states is actually pretty conservative, but they tend to vote for Democratic candidates because of some of the underlying values and the lack of arms wide open, I guess, approach from more conservative parties or more conservative candidates. But I don't really think that this comes down to partisanship or ideology so much as trying to make those logical connections among groups.
And in speaking to him, we crossed the street from his campaign announcement and spoke at Germax Pistachio Roasters Cafe. And speaking to him, listening to him articulate his message, it was really something that was tinged with sort of the economic populism of Bernie Sanders and people of his progressive ilk. And this is a message that is really about keeping families healthy, protecting the environment, and ensuring everyone has a fair chance in our economy.
I guess one thing I do want to say is it is often very, very difficult to be a Detroit candidate and try to move that. I mean, and not even, you know, his religion, his race, his name, all that stuff aside, I think it is very difficult for a Detroit candidate to move the message outside, largely because the rest of the state views Detroit as a problem, not a solution.
All right, well, let's set up this interview, Simon.
Yeah, well, so when we spoke, we talked about his vision for the city, and, I mean, he has a considerable track record in articulating his message, but the thing is, his track record is based in Detroit, and it was a non-elected position. And listening to him articulate his message, we really see his attempt to kind of bring his message, which has been very city-centric, to a statewide audience.
So Dr. Abdullah said, you are someone with, we might say, impeccable credentials, you know. Speak about a little bit about how your background, what led, you know, the decisions and the experiences that led you to this decision to pursue a gubernatorial bid.
Yeah, my career has always been about people. I grew up dreaming of becoming a doctor. And as I progressed through my career, I realized that the things that I wanted to be about had a lot more to do with the ways that we organize our society and how that locks certain people out, whether that's an economic system that caters a lot more to an elite than it does to working people, or an education system that's flaking and unfortunately failing our future, or it's a public health system that has failed and poisoned 9,000 kids in Flint. All of those things are about how we make decisions as a society. Now, my values are fundamentally about investing in the well-being and opportunities for the most vulnerable, believing in equity and believing that science is the best way of making hard decisions in a complex world. And as health director, I have served those aims with everything I had. And then I realized after Donald Trump won the election that neither in Lansing nor in D.C. do we have leaders who believe in the kinds of values that I believe in. And so if one does not invest in in solving problems themselves, does not stand up and say, you know, I'm going to do my part to address this, well then you can't keep pointing. And so I'd much rather be on the offensive, fighting for the values that I believe in, than on the defensive, trying to play defense and save whatever's left when our leaders are unwilling to come to terms with the fact that government should be about people and for people and by people. And that means that we have to be thinking about their opportunities rather than how we cut costs and cut corners.
Now, while this is your first bid for political office, you just resigned from your position as Director of Public Health with the City of Detroit. Can you speak to some of your work as director and how that might form a bit of a track record for you to run on?
Yeah, so I have real experience serving real people. I was responsible for the health and well-being of 677,000 Detroiters in a city where our infant mortality rates are worse than Mexico's, where our asthma rates are three times the rest of the state, where our lead rates are higher than the rest of the state of Michigan. And that experience of building an institution, fundamentally rebuilding an institution that had been shut down and privatized before I came, it's taught me some things about building and leading institutions that matter. As health director, I led initiatives on everything from building a program that trains women to be peer mentors for pregnant women to reduce infant mortality. I led an initiative to provide glasses for every kid in the city of Detroit, delivered at school. Via optometry tests that are coordinated. I led an initiative to test every single school for lead in the water. That's 360 schools and daycares in 6 months after we witnessed what happened in Flint. And I stood up to corporate polluters who put their profits over our children's lungs. You know, when Marathon Petroleum wanted to raise its sulfur dioxide emissions, we fought them. And they invested $10 million to reduce their emissions. And that's because we were able to get them to recognize what it was that they were doing, why it mattered, and to work with them to find a solution. I rebuilt an animal control division in our department. When I came in, we were unfortunately putting down 86% of the dogs that had come in. And after once we finished that work, we were in the position where we were putting out 67% of our dogs for adoption. We had lowered our bite numbers 30%. That's real work, serving real people in real places, solving real problems, taking care and taking responsibility for people in ways that voting a bill up or down is not.
So after a Republican governor who has been in office for two terms was also presiding over an enormous human and economic crisis in the city of Flint, do you think that the time is, whenever someone is running for two terms as governor, someone has been in office for two terms, the election becomes about change. Can you speak to what you're looking to change in terms of your vision for the state?
Well, the Snyder administration's vision for government was that it should be run like a business. Here's the problem with that. Businesses cater to people who can pay. And so what you end up having is a system of government that's really focused on elites and not as focused on common people. My work has always been, as a doctor, an educator, a public servant, has been about how we build opportunities for people. And so government is not a business. Government is government. Government has a responsibility to be focusing on our most vulnerable, building opportunities for them. And I think there are ways for us to be embracing the economic opportunities of tomorrow, building real jobs that are sustainable into the long term. There are ways for us to reinvest in public education in a way that the Snyder administration has fundamentally disinvested. And there are ways for us to rebuild public health. And those are three issues that really force us to be thinking about government as an organ of the people's will that serves people in real ways. And that is, I think, a fundamental difference from the way that Snyder and his accountants think about government.
So you've referred to yourself as a devout Muslim, but at the same time, your background and upbringing is not homogenous. Can you speak to some of your influences growing up and as a child that will give yourself broad appeal as a candidate?
Yeah, my family looks like America. Everybody from a Muslim imam to a Presbyterian deacon in her church from Flint to a family that's been in Gratiot County for generations. And these are the people who grew up. I grew up with, who raised me, who taught me how to think about the world, and who continue to contribute to my well-being and my sense of where we are and where we need to be as a society. I am a devout Muslim, but I don't think that's anything different than saying I was a devout Christian or a devout Jew. We are a country where we believe in the separation of church and state, and nobody understands how important that is more than a religious minority. And so to me, it is of our country and of the greatest aspects of our country that we can move beyond any perceived differences to embrace a set of values that are fundamentally American, that are not mutually exclusive in any way from my faith. As a Muslim, I was raised to believe in the well-being of the vulnerable. I was raised to believe that evidence matters. I was raised to believe in equity, that all people deserve a fair shot at life, regardless of where they come from, what color their skin is, how they choose to pray, who they are attracted to. And those are teachings that I derive from my faith, and they're teachings that I derive from my American ideals. And I do hope that that our America is big enough where we can embrace one another across our differences, and because of our differences, because of how amazing our ideals are and how inclusive they are, and because we believe in an equity that's an ideal of America that's bigger than any one group or color.
Now, in your campaign speech, you spoke about how the struggles of poor white folk and poor black folk are very similar. How are you going to extend this message of creating a more just society for all to from the lessons that you learned in Detroit to communities like Petoskey, Traverse City, Marquette?
You know, one of the things that you learn how to do very quickly in medical school is listen. And I think people will always listen to you if you've listened to them first. So I want to go on a listening tour across the state of Michigan, and I want to listen. I want to hear everyone's stories. I want to understand what's challenging them. I want to hear what their hopes and dreams and aspirations for their children look like. And I want to understand that. And then I want to talk. I want to talk about what we can do together. Because in the end, there's this idea that there's a zero-sum game, that our handouts must be going to Detroit and not going to those places, or our jobs must be going to China and not staying here. But in the long term, we have to focus on the future that is before us, our shared future. That's a future that's independent of whether you are poor and black in Detroit, or you are working and black in Detroit, or you are poor and white in Petoskey, or you're working and white in Petoskey. That future, that ideal, that we need our children to prosper, and we need to believe in their future, and we need to do the things that make that future sustainable. Well, that's universal, and that's something, you know, if and when I hopefully am elected governor, I'll be governor for everybody, and I will judge myself and my leadership based on how those who voted for me and did not vote for me believe in my leadership. And that means going everywhere, listening to everybody, understanding the challenges they face, coming up with creative solutions together, and implementing them with the same kind of efficiency that we did at the Detroit Health Department here while I was director.
These shared values and the idea that they can counter some of the political and cultural divisions that our country is currently experiencing, what sort of role is that going to play in your campaign?
Look, people like Trump have sold us a lie. And that lie is that that somehow if we fight each other, we're going to be better off. That's just fights never fed anyone. Fights, they never created jobs for anyone. They never educated anyone. They never fixed a broken public health system. We have an opportunity right now to come together, to believe in something that's bigger than any one of us individually. And that to me is what I'm about. That's what I want to do. Because in the end, I know that poor and working people in Detroit love their children the same way that poor and working people in Petoskey love their children. And to be honest, they're all of our children because they're our future. So that's what I'm working to build. And I don't have kids yet, but I know that I worry about the society that I'll leave them. And I want to do everything I can to build that for my kids, for their kids, whether it's Petoskey or Detroit.
Well, Dr. Elsad, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
No, I really appreciate you taking the time to come here. Thank you.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, Abdul Elsad, for taking some time and speaking with Simon. The sad news of the day, oh, God, I hate listening to Candle in the Wind. Why does Candle in the Wind always have to play when we've got sad news? Abigail Wall's her final podcast as she moves on. Would you like to say sayonara, please?
Sayonara, please. No. I am sad. This is my last podcast. Hopefully, I'll see everyone I move on to.
Well, now we say last as a member of MERS staff. Now, you could come on in a different capacity at some point. We bring back friends. Emily's been back. Craig's been back. We bring folks back. Maybe we shouldn't say this isn't so final. It's not like you're moving to Greece or something.
I hope not to be, you know, completely irrelevant. I am just moving over to PR, not, you know, to, as you say, Greece or Siam.
Jacob, this is a sad moment here. I was thinking about putting some her car on blocks or something so she couldn't leave.
Seems a little drastic and might be against employee policy.
You don't need to help it.
Is there anything else that you have thought of, Jacob, that we can do to prevent Abby from going back to the dark side?
I mean, I don't know. We could entice her with more Cravings popcorn. What's the Cravings popcorn policy over at your new workshop?
It was the mint popcorn that drove me out of the office.
Toothpaste popcorn.
Oh, you sold out for the cheap popcorn deal, and you brought home the mint popcorn.
An enormous jumbo bag that I managed to eat over a 3-week period of time because no one else decided to touch it.
It was more like 5 weeks.
But yeah. You know, which may sound still impressive, but people should know that we, as a MERS staff, can go through a popcorn bag in 1 week. So 3 weeks to 5 weeks was a long haul for you, especially.
We should also note that these bags are the largest quantity of popcorn craving cells.
As tall as a kindergartner.
And I think we can go through a single one of those things in 3 days. Kettle corn go in 3 days at one point.
I think that your decision to change popcorn flavors recently was a strategic one. You had to temper down our appetites so that we didn't blow through this expensive popcorn
so that I would have more of it.
Speaker Leonard should get an honorary shout out here for our recent popcorn consumption, because I know when I have these long days, I come into the office and just have bowl after bowl of that stuff. So.
And it's wonderful, too. Well, Abigail, we are going to miss your insight on a weekly basis. You've been a tremendous add to this organization, and we appreciate the time that you have put into making this a great product. We are going to miss you badly, but good luck and best wishes as you go forward, and please don't cry. Thank you. All right, and with that, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moran. Take care. Complex, talking and pulling.